This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. In Springfield today, Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich presides over the swearing-in of the state Senate that will soon sit as the jury at his impeachment trial. In Washington, Roland Burris will take his seat in the United States Senate tomorrow. Hillary looks like a slam dunk for state. Minnesota, who knows? It's Wednesday, when you can always count on the political junkie.
There you go again.
When I hear your new ideas, I'm reminded of that ad. Where's the beef?
Extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice.
You don't have Nixon to kick around anymore.
Lipstick.
But I'm the decider.
On Wednesdays, NPR political editor Ken Rudin joins us to talk politics. And as usual, there is a lot to talk about. Confirmation hearings for Obama's cabinet picks. Two states still don't have senators. Two more Republicans will not run again. More on that later in the show with former RNC chair and current Mississippi Governor Haley Barbour. Conservatives break bread with Obama and President Bush bids farewell to the White House press corps. But we begin first, as always, with a trivia question. Political junkie Ken Rudin joins us here in Studio 3A. Hey, Ken.
Hi, Neil.
And what's the trivia question this
week? It is. Well, history will be made at next week's inauguration, as we all know. I'm the first to tell you this. But when was the closest time America came to having an African-American first lady?
If you think you know, the closest America came to having an African-American first lady prior to this year, give us a call, 800-989-8255, or zap us an email. The address is talk@npr.org. There's always a conversation underway at our website, too. That's at npr.org. Just go to Talk of the Nation. And, Ken, let's begin with the sound as the Illinois Senate greeted Governor Rod Blagojevich today in Springfield, Illinois.
Exactly.
That was a craft fact, a recreation of what's being described as stony silence as the governor of the state of Illinois.
We had to pay big to get that tape.
It was really important. But this story just gets stranger and stranger.
Well, it is strange. I mean, he was impeached by a close vote of 114-1 in the Illinois House. And now, of course, it goes to the Senate where 2/3 are needed to convict him and remove him from office. Probably happened later this month. Blagojevich insists that he has not committed any crimes and he'll be proven innocent. And for all we know, he might be. I mean, but the point is, in many times, impeachment cases is more political. A lot of Democrats insist that the Bill Clinton impeachment trial was more about politics than anything he may have done wrong. And so, but it was very a surreal thing today for Rod Blagojevich to preside in the state Senate as they were swearing in the new members, the same members who will try him later this month.
And in the meantime, the man who was tainted by the Blagojevich nod to go to the United States Senate will be tomorrow sworn in as the junior senator from Illinois.
Roland Burris, the guy who Harry Reid said absolutely no way will he be seated by the United States Senate. Barack Obama agreed. He said there's no way anybody Rod Blagojevich picks will be certified by the Senate. But here it is. Roland Burris will be sworn in probably tomorrow, 2 p.m. Eastern time. Vice President Dick Cheney probably swear him in. And he will be only the fourth African-American senator in history, following, of course, Ed Brook, Carol Moseley Braun, and Barack Obama.
And to vote on the confirmation of Hillary Clinton for United States for Secretary of State.
Right, and she had her confirmation hearings yesterday. Went pretty smoothly. There, of course, are some questions. Dick Lugar, the ranking Republican on foreign relations, did bring up the point, and it's a valid point, that there is a sense of wonderment how all these people who gave millions of dollars to the Bill Clinton Foundation, are they trying to curry favor with Hillary Clinton, either as senator or now as a Secretary of State? And she said, well, all the agreements, the I's have been dotted and the T's have been crossed. But there are questions, and it was interesting that very few Republicans brought it up yesterday's confirmation hearings.
Well, the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, the new chairman, John Kerry, of course, Joe Biden, the former chairman, will have a new job next week. But the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee was asked on Morning Joe today about what Hillary Clinton has to worry about. And he said, well, she has to worry about waking up and waiting for the vote because she's a slam dunk.
Right. And the vote comes tomorrow. And even though there are questions about, you know, the possible conflict of interest, I have not heard a single Republican say that they would vote against her. Part of it is that she's a member of the club, member of the Senate. But, you know, John Tower was a member of the Senate, too, when he was picked by the the first President Bush to be Secretary of Defense in 1989, and he did not survive that that confirmation.
Let's go on. We'll get back to the confirmation hearings in a minute, but nevertheless, jockeying continues for Senator Clinton's seat in New York.
That's exactly right. It was reported by the New York Daily News today that yesterday, Andrew Cuomo, the state's state attorney general, who is yet to publicly say that he wants to be considered for the Senate seat.
On the other hand, touring Rochester.
Exactly, exactly. The only person who did that was Jack Benny. Okay, so anyway, so yeah, thank you very much. So David Patterson interviewed Andrew Cuomo yesterday. Last Saturday, he the governor met with Caroline Kennedy, who has expressed, you know, strong interest in that seat. Other members of Congress are also interested. Kirsten Gillibrand, Steve Israel from Long Island, Carolyn Maloney from Manhattan. Patterson is, again, there are polls out there. There's a new poll out that shows that more people want Andrew Cuomo for the new Senate instead of Caroline Kennedy, who finishes a close second. But really, there's only one voter in this, and that's David Patterson.
And all the candidates are being asked to pass a test.
Right. There is a 24-page questionnaire that could be found on my blog, politicaljunkie.org.
Political Junkie is a blog?
Yeah. Did
no,
I tell
kidding.
You?
No,
yes.
I write anything about that.
I do that. Yeah. Over five people read it.
Here's the sound of people greeting the Political Junkie. Now, go ahead.
Okay. So it's very interesting. All questions, any possible conflict of interest. As a matter of fact, one of the questions Patterson asks of these prospective senators is, do you write a blog? So that, obviously, that's one of the reasons why Ken Rudin is not
Qualified, considered. But, you know, who played first base for the New York Giants in 1923 is probably one of the questions on this test. It is quite exhaustive and very amusing. Let's see. We have some emails. This is from in answer to the trivia question. And this
did we ask one yet?
Yeah, we did ask a trivia question. When was the previous time America came closest to having an African-American first lady? This one from Alton, as spouse to Secretary of State Colin Powell. Alma Powell is his guest.
Of course, Colin Powell never ran for president. A lot of Republicans wanted him to run in 1996. Perhaps had he run, Alma Powell would have been close to being first African-American first lady, but he never ran for president.
Reportedly because Alma wouldn't let him.
That's right.
Let's get a caller on the line. This is Derek, and Derek with us from Heartland, Vermont.
Yes, how are you?
Hi, very well.
This is totally off the wall, but I was thinking about Sally Hemings.
Well, Sally Hemings, of course, was the
Thomas Jefferson's wife.
Not Thomas Jefferson's wife.
And I guess you're almost tempted to do a smart alecky joke here, but there's nothing funny about the raping of a slave by Thomas Jefferson. But she was not first lady.
I know she wasn't first lady, but she was pretty close.
Pretty close. Yeah. Not bad.
Could have been common law back then.
Look, you have an argument, Derek. You have an argument. Are you a lawyer by any chance?
I am certainly not.
All right. Thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
Okay.
Let's see if we can go now to, this is Paul. Paul with us from Watertown, Massachusetts.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I'm saying Richard Mentor Johnson.
Who?
The ninth vice president of the United States, who's Van Buren's vice president, and his wife was mixed race. So if Van Buren had to give it up or gotten assassinated, it would have been her.
Well, I had not heard that argument, and I'm looking across at Ken Rudin, and who's
speechless.
Speechless.
I love that answer, but that's not what I was thinking. I don't think that Mrs. Johnson was the closest, but there was somebody much closer who almost became the first African-American first lady.
Well, you try.
All right. Nice try, Paul.
All right.
Appreciate the phone call. Email from Larry, we should note, also argues for Sally Hemings and Thomas Jefferson. And let's go now to Laura, and Laura with us from San Antonio.
Hi. I have to say I just love you two. You're as good as Abbott and Costello. Waiting for the news.
He's the fat one.
Wait a minute.
It was Teresa Hines Carey.
Excellent.
Ding, 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 ding.
Excellent. Teresa Hines Carey was born in Mozambique in 1938. She's the wife, of course, of John Kerry, the 2004 Democratic nominee. Her parents were Portuguese, and she was born in Mozambique.
Which makes her African, and then she married Mr. Hines and became African-American.
That's right.
There you go.
All right, Laura, you win the no prize this week.
Thank you.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And let's get back to those confirmation hearings in the United States Senate. There was one little problem yesterday with the new proposed Secretary for the Treasury.
Oh, man. You know, I don't know why they would think that the person who's in charge of the IRS should know the tax code or pay his taxes. Now, what happened is Tim Geithner is President-elect Obama's choice to be Secretary of the Treasury. When he worked for the IMF from 2001 to 2003.
That's the International Monetary Fund.
Right, International Monetary Fund. He did not pay Social Security and Medicare taxes for part of those years. And so they only found out about this. Actually, it was the Obama transition team that found out about this in November 2008, prior to his announcement as a Treasury Secretary designate. He paid the back taxes with interest. And apparently they told the senators back in December that this incident had happened. Now, the word out there is that it's much to do about nothing. Finance Committee Chairman Max Baucus said it's nothing. John Kerry said it's nothing. Robert Gibbs, the Obama campaign committee chair, said it's nothing. Harry Reid said it's just a bunch of a few hiccups, and nothing should derail the confirmation of Geithner. However, they have now moved the confirmation hearings, which was scheduled to be a quickie on Friday, to next Wednesday. There are concerns. Chuck Grassley, the ranking Republican on finance, said these are serious charges. Do we think that this will derail the nomination? Probably not. Obviously, so much is at stake to have a Treasury Secretary in place, given all the problems out there. But for a campaign that really was perfect, basically, for the most part, it's been far less than perfect since November 4th. The embarrassing disclosures about Bill Richardson, who had to withdraw as Commerce Secretary, the whole Blagojevich / Burris mess, not telling Dianne Feinstein about Leon Panetta. I mean, it's not a major thing, but it's an embarrassment, if nothing else.
Speed bumps are on the way to an inauguration.
Speed bumps, perhaps. So Geithner may very well be confirmed, but again, it was an embarrassment to a heretofore smooth-sailing Obama transition.
And we should note that the governor of Virginia, Tim Kaine, at one time mentioned as a possible vice presidential candidate for Barack Obama, was chosen to be the next chair of the Democratic National Committee, what the DNC chair does when the party's in power in the White House, a little bit obscure. But nevertheless, we are going to have the former chair of the Republican National Committee and the current governor of Mississippi, Haley Barbour, join us in just a couple of minutes to talk about the future of the Republican Party. So stay with us for that. If you've got questions, give us a call, 800-989-8255, or send us an email, talk@npr.org. More with Political Junkie in just a moment. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And take over this beautiful land. And take over this beautiful land. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Ken Rudin is with us, NPR's political editor and our political junkie every Wednesday. If you don't get enough Ken on the radio, you can find his new blog. Can we still call it new?
Yes.
Yes, we can still call it new. That's at npr.org. And Democrats who are looking forward to, years and years, maybe decades of smooth sailing ahead should remember it was just 4 years ago when Republicans were talking about a permanent Republican majority. Things can change very quickly in national politics, and nobody knows that better than Haley Barbour, the governor of Mississippi, the former head of the Republican National Committee, and he joins us now on the phone. And Governor Barbour, very good of you to be with us today.
Well, Neil, thank you very much for having me.
And is it easy to tell Republicans there is a light at the end of the tunnel and it's not a train coming at them?
Well, it's easy to tell them that, but the proof's in the pudding, and we won't know. I mean, when I became chairman of our party, it was the last time that we had lost the White House after occupying it, in that case, for 12 years. And we had a lot of progress and success very early. We won back the House and we won back the Senate, and we won the House for the first time in 40 years in 1994, only 2 years. But that doesn't necessarily mean that'll happen this time. A lot depends on how President-elect Obama does. And as an American, I hope he does well. I mean, I hope that he has success for our country. But we just have to see.
There was some difficult. Any time a party loses the majority, it suddenly encourages a lot of people to retire rather than run for re-election. That happened to Republicans a lot, not just in the House of Representatives, but in the Senate as well. And it's already happening for 2010. Four Republicans have said they do not plan to run again in 2010.
That's right. And that's not atypical. After you've been in the majority for a while, a minority's not so sporty. And but at the same time, it's healthy that when you lose the White House, you have the chance to rebuild your party from the bottom up. And you have some very attractive, capable members who say now is the time to bring on somebody younger, to bring on somebody who's got a fresh set of eyes, that we're going to be in a transition. And instead of me, the member that served for years and years, sticking around, let's see if we can't bring somebody else on that's got a much longer future horizon to look at than I do. And as I say, I think that's healthy. Politics is cyclical. But also, static politics is not what Americans want. It's really not in the best interest of the country.
If you look at the states carried by John McCain this year, the party looks like it could have difficulties in the future. Some people say the Republican Party was pretty well confined to a couple of states in the Midwest and the states of the old Confederacy, and not all of those. How does the Republican Party make itself strong enough to compete for congressional seats in the Northeast and on the West Coast?
Well, I remember in 1988 when Governor Dukakis carried so little of the country, he got beat by an even larger amount than McCain got beat by. And yet, 4 years later, the Democrats elected Bill Clinton president. Politics is always moving, always flowing. It's a people business. Issues tend to change. People's values don't change, but the issue set that those values and principles are applied to changed. And think about George Bush's election in 2000. Who would have thought that within 9 months of his inauguration, September 11th, would have changed so much about our world and the political landscape of America? I don't have sense enough or any ability to look around the corners or over the horizon, but we all know that change is something that happens in America very regularly.
Let's see if we can get a caller in on the conversation. 800-989-8255. Let's get Sonny on the line. Sonny with us from Rocky Mount, North Carolina.
Thank you. My question for Governor Barbour is this. Where do you see some young, fresh upstarts coming from the Republican Party? You know, it seems that the Republicans need to become, of which I am a Republican, need to become more cerebral and definitely stick to bedrock principles, but become better at communicating to the masses why those are principles that would resonate with many, many people rather than what became the minority in this last election.
Sonny, you made about 3 points there, every one of which is important and salient. Republicans sometimes sound like accountants when we talk about issues. One of the things we tried to do when I was chairman of the party was to encourage our members to learn how to talk about issues, not only what I'm for, but why I'm for it and how it helps families and communities have a better life. And sometimes we stop after the first thing. Lamar Alexander used to say Republicans were guilty of talking in shorthand. A second thing is that we do have to regain our position as the party of ideas. During the Reagan years, very clearly, Republican ideas changed the economy. They changed much of the way the country operated. And President Clinton, as his administration, particularly during the 3/4 of the time it had a Republican Congress, really kept a lot of the Reagan principles in effect. And so did George Bush. But now we're 28 years later, and the issues have changed in many ways. We're dealing with things that weren't at issue in the 1980s or 90s. So Republicans have to regain our positions of party ideas by applying our principles and our values to these new issue sets or to issues that have changed dramatically or at least significantly over the period of time. But you're right about this. People don't vote for Republicans because they got elephants behind their names. They vote for what they think is the right thing for the government to do or not do. And if they believe the Republicans got the right ideas about what the government ought to be doing and not doing, then they'll vote for Republicans.
And what would you advise young Republicans like myself to do if we're looking at the Republican Party, we're excited about the future and the way to evolve into a party that connects with more American people based on our fundamental values and principles? how can we go about making a difference if we're outside of the system right now?
Well, Sonny, that's a great thing about the system. When you're in the White House for 8 years or 12 years, you become a top-down party. And the same thing happens to the Democrats when they're in the White House for a long period of time. So we've just ended a period where we have been a top-down party, and a lot of young people like you, and a lot of old people for that matter, just felt like they hadn't had much of a voice. Now we're going to rebuild our party as a bottom-up party. And we need you to get involved. Get involved at the local level. Get involved at the congressional level in North Carolina or even the state level. Ultimately, get involved at the national level if that's what you're interested in doing. But participation, if my party will, in my opinion, do what we did 16 years ago, and that is create a process that is inclusive, that's participatory, that gives every Republican a chance to have a voice, not just by writing a check, but to have a voice as we develop and redevelop public policy. And, Sonny, we need people like you to be part of that.
Well, Sonny, when you go to the White House, we'll hope you'll join us here on Political Junkie.
I promise I'll do it, Neil. Thanks.
Okay, thanks very much for the phone call. Ken?
Governor Barber, I don't know if you realize this, but you're the last Republican to lose a Senate seat in Mississippi, but that's not what I'm about to ask you.
I hope I'm going to keep that record for quite a long time, Ken.
Many people suggest that the beginning of the end for the Republican Party in 2006, 2008 was not so much Iraq, but it was the perception of the government's response to Hurricane Katrina. President Bush, at his exit interview at his press conference this week, said actually it was misunderstood by many people that actually the government performed well. Now, of course, you had a major role in it. You saw it up close. You were reelected overwhelmingly for what you did in Katrina. How would you assess the federal government's role in the aftermath of Katrina?
In actuality, the federal government did a whole lot more right than wrong. But I do think you're correct. The perception was because some of FEMA's early systems didn't work. Their logistical system totally flopped right at the beginning. And because of that, the perception of most people in the country is the government didn't get their job done. And it really did hurt Bush, and I think it was one of the things that got him tripped up for going forward. But the truth of the matter is, look, we all made mistakes. State governments made mistakes. Local governments made mistakes. And, Ken, anybody that tells you that you can bear the brunt of the worst natural disaster in American history and everything you do in response is going to go perfectly, just doesn't know what they're talking about. But that doesn't take away that in our business, of course, perception is reality. And the perception is that the federal government did not do a good job. The truth is they did a whole lot better than they get credit for, though it was far from perfect.
Well, FEMA trailer is still an expression people use with contempt.
Yeah, but look, I'll tell you a story about FEMA trailers. The Stafford Act was passed long, long before George Bush was president. The Stafford Act is the federal disaster assistance law. The Stafford Act says that when the federal government puts in housing because of a disaster, it has to be temporary housing. Now, there are people in Mississippi that have lived in FEMA trailers for 3 years. The federal government, under the existing law, doesn't have the authority to build more permanent housing for these people, housing that's intended to last for 5 years, because the Stafford Act was really designed with the things in mind like a tornado, a river flood, where you provide somebody a FEMA trailer, which, by the way, is a misnomer. It isn't a trailer. It's a camper. It's miserable to ask a family to live in a place for 2 or 3 years that was designed for you to spend the weekend by pulling it up to the lake or taking it down to the beach. But that's not the Bush administration may get the blame for that, but they had nothing to do with the Stafford Act, and for 3.5 years, Congress still has not changed that. And again, I'm not mad at Congress about it, but we have to realize that an administration has to live within the law, and FEMA trailers, to my great disgust, are what the law has been looked at as requiring you to do. And as you know, Ken, we developed an alternative to FEMA trailers as disaster housing here in Mississippi. We call it Katrina Cottage or the Mississippi Cottage. And hopefully the government is going to pick it up and use it in the future.
Can you take one call more with us?
Sure.
All right, let's get Daniel on the line. Excuse me. Daniel's calling us from Naples, Florida.
Hi, guys. It's an honor to talk to you, Mr. Barber. You know,
you're going to be a mighty pretty place.
Thank you. As a Republican, I was turned off somewhat by the tone of the immigration debate within our party. I supported John McCain's comprehensive kind of policy. And I'm wondering, you know, it seems to me that if we wouldn't have lost some of that Latino vote, maybe we would have come pretty close to winning. How are we going to get beyond kind of a traditional white male voting block? Do you think there's something that we need to repair there, and how are we going to do it?
You know, candidly, I was surprised that Senator McCain didn't do better among Hispanic voters, because he had been so out front and so diligent, and he stayed stuck in trying to get an immigration bill passed, but at the end of the day, it didn't inure to his benefit at the polls. You know, what I think we ought to do is what's good policy. I would hate to think where Mississippi would be after Katrina if it hadn't been for the Spanish speakers that came down to the coast to help us rebuild. Lots of them are legal, but I have no doubt that some of them weren't. But we would have been... We would be far, far behind if not for that, and I think we ought to recognize that. We have some industries in our state like the poultry industry. Poultry is our biggest agricultural product, and almost all the production workers are Spanish speakers. The fact of the matter is we're in a recession right now, and unemployment's going to go up. But I'm 61 years old, and as an American, I know good and well I am in my lifetime, if I live to be what I'm supposed to, that we're going to see labor shortages in this country just like the Europeans are, because our population is not growing fast enough, and I, for one, hope our economy gets back growing, and we're going to need people for those jobs. So I think if we'll follow good policy, what's right for America, then what you're going to see is our ability to do a lot better among voters who's either grew up speaking Spanish or whose parents did. And if we don't, the math works very hard against us.
Daniel,
the reason to do it isn't the political math. The reason to do it is to do what's right for the country.
Daniel, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And Governor Barber, we're going to let you go.
Hey, Neil. Thanks. Ken, good talk to you.
Thank you, Governor.
Haley Barber, a former chair of the Republican Party, the current governor of Mississippi. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And a couple of other things to talk about, Ken, before we wind up this week. And one of them, a very surprising dinner at George Will's house last night, where he broke bread with the ideological opposition, a Chicago White Sox fan.
That's right. He had the president-elect, Barack Obama, was at George Will's house in suburban Virginia, and so other conservatives were there, too. Part of the rumor is that the president-elect wanted to keep his enemies...
His house is in Maryland.
In Maryland, I'm sorry. But he wanted to keep his enemies closer, you know, the old expression.
Yes, right.
But it was kind of interesting that there's no reports about what happened, what was discussed at that meeting.
Yeah, because it was all off the record, on the plate, but off the record.
Right.
Anyway, also, we did mention two more Republican senators announced that they're not going to be running for re-election. Four overall, the two new ones, Kit Bond and George Voinovich.
Right, and then George Voinovich in Ohio, Rob Portman, the former congressman and former trade representative, announced today his candidacy for the Voinovich seat. The Democrats, of course, have been on a comeback in Ohio. They've been winning big races lately there. They're going to fight for that seat very hard, obviously.
And this email that's coming in from Dee in Rochester, New York. Hey, don't denigrate or negate Rochester, as in your comment about Cuomo visiting here. We have a lot of voters and a lot of listeners to you and other shows. Watch what you say. Hey, we love WXXI and the city of Rochester, New York, of course, famous for its Kodak factories. Well, whatever happened to them? Ken, thanks very much.
Thanks, Neil. And we'll talk more about what's happening. Maybe we'll have a Minnesota senator by next week.
Well, you never know. Stranger things have happened. That one will come out of the freezer. Political junkie Ken Rudin joins us every Wednesday on Talk of the Nation. You can read his Political Junkie blog at npr.org. And he will begin with us again next week. I think next Wednesday.
I think that's the way it works.
Next Wednesday. Pardon me? And Tuesday, when we, of course, he'll join us for special coverage of the inauguration in the 2 o'clock hour for NPR special coverage on Inauguration Day. So 2 days in a row of Ken Rudin, if you can stand it. I'm Neil Conan. Stay with us. When we come back, we're going to be talking about newly rediscovered history of the African-American slaves who built the White House. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.